Our guest this hour is Joseph R. Reisert, a Harriet S. and George C. Wiswell Jr. Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law and Chair of the Department of Government at Colby College. You can join us by phone this morning at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number anywhere you can hear this broadcast. If you're in Milwaukee, please use our local number. It's area code 414-227-2050, 227-2050. Good morning, Professor Reisert. Okay, I cannot hear the professor. Somebody needs to take care of that. Professor Reisert, are you there?
I'm here. Good morning.
Okay, good. All right, now we have things connected. Technology is sometimes our friend and oftentimes a source of annoyance. Well, let's start the program off by asking, what did you think was the top political story of the past week?
Well, I know the one everyone is talking about is Scooter Libby. But I think the bigger news is really the defection of the Republican senators from the president's position on the war. And that's got deeper significance.
Is this, I hate to use this analogy, I'm probably going to get lots of mail. Is this rats deserting a sinking ship?
Well, yeah, I don't want to use the analogy either. But
well, I already did, so you're off the hook.
They clearly are walking away from a policy that, they can't persuade anyone has succeeded. Go on.
I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
The news from Iraq, there are slivers of good in it, but the general tenor of it is bad, and it's not surprising that with public opinion turning the way it is, that you're going to see Republican senators trying to distance themselves from the president.
Well, and in the wake of the announcement of various defections, we hear about new plans to try to get language placed in budget bills and so forth that would allow Congress to kind of take control of the war and bring it to an end. In the House of Representatives, which the Democrats hold a majority, it's perhaps maybe a little more liberal. I almost hate to even use that word because it's become so meaningless. But in the Senate, many of the Democrats elected in the last election were more moderate. And it looks like there may be some sort of a center compromise between moderate Democrats and some Republicans to get something passed that at least lets the president know that they want something to change. There needs to be a change. But regardless, does any of that matter? The president has the veto pen, and there you go.
Well, the president has the veto pen, but the money will run out, right? They appropriated funds only through sometime in the fall. And so at some point, Congress either has to start funding the war or the money stops flowing. And there's only so much the administration can do to reallocate funds from other Defense Department purposes to support the war. I mean, sooner or later, when the money runs out, the troops have to come home. That's a way of ending a conflict that no one would like, though. And I know, up to now, the Democrats have wanted to avoid just starkly presenting the administration with, your allowance has been cut off. Deal with it.
Well, and they want to avoid the appearance of not supporting the troops who are on the ground in Iraq.
Well, absolutely. And, getting whatever it is, 150,000 troops out of Iraq is a complicated logistical problem, right? I mean, you've got to get material and people whether airlifted or driven across dangerous roads into secure positions or flown to the United States, what have you. I mean, that's itself a major military operation that's got to be paid for. So that fact really does complicate the Democrats' position and the Republicans, too.
And even the you mentioned that the withdrawal from Iraq would be complicated. It would be extremely dangerous for the last troops who are left on the ground, because they would have some problems just defending themselves so that they could get on the planes or whatever transport to get home once the troop levels reach a certain point.
Right,
and
absolutely.
You've also got the issue of the contract workers that we have over there that aren't included in those numbers of military personnel.
Absolutely. I mean, it is a very complicated military operation. Again, I'm not a soldier. I couldn't give you the details. But I think that fact is part of what limits the options of those who in Congress would like to say, you know what, we have the ultimate legislative weapon, we can just decline to appropriate money. But really, at the end of the day, declining to appropriate money would put people in danger simply because withdrawal is so difficult. That's why you need the president on board.
And it doesn't sound like he's interested in compromise.
Well, so far he doesn't appear to be, although there's nothing like losing key senators in your own party to draw attention to the importance of doing something. I think the president's position is that, and to this extent it's reasonable, that the opponents of the war know what they're against, right? The policy does not appear to be working. The Iraqi government is not making the compromises that we, I think, quite appropriately think they need to make. And so we look and we see this is a nightmare. Let's get ourselves out of this nightmare. But what we're not really hearing enough of is, well, what's the better alternative for securing America's long-term interest? We all agree that doing what we're doing now isn't working. But the president's, either he's crazy or something like that, but he may be reasonably saying, well, no one has an alternative that's based on what makes Iraq better. Everyone else's alternative is based on what makes American politics work for them.
Well, it is the election season, or the silly season, as some people like to call it. What obligation does President Bush have to the Republican Party and to the people running for president? He won't have to face these problems again because he's done after this term. But what obligation does he have to the people who are going to be running, basically on his record, whatever it is?
Well, that's an excellent question. He has certainly no legal obligation. Does he have a moral obligation? Certainly the Republican Party lined up very early behind Governor Bush, 1998, 1999. It was already pretty clear that he was going to be the party's nominee. You would think that the strong support he got from the party early on would create in him a sense of obligation. But so far we haven't seen it. President Bush's loyalty seems to be to individual persons who are very close to him. He doesn't seem to be particularly close to any of the front runners. So far, there's not much evidence that, in his policy decisions, that he's feeling that kind of loyalty. So I don't think it's going to be a big factor for him.
Speaking of presidential politics, there were several articles out last week talking about various campaigns and financial burnout, that they were burning through a lot of cash in what is essentially the very early parts of the campaign, and we're already starting to have to make staff moves, and usually that means cutbacks. The McCain campaign had some layoffs last week. Senator Edwards was talking. His campaign was looking at reorganizing its staff, and that's usually a euphemism for we have to get rid of some people because we're running out of cash. Meanwhile, you have front runners on the Democratic side, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, seeming to have almost an endless supply of money. Is money getting to be the way we keep score in terms of who's still a viable candidate and who isn't?
Certainly money has attracted a lot of attention. And it's not actually unreasonable at this stage, too, since what you really look at, even in addition to the dollar amount, are the numbers of people giving money. One of the great benefits of the Internet is that it makes it easy and cost-effective for people to give $25 or $100 or, relatively small amounts of money. And one of the impressive things behind the big Obama number is, how many individual donors there were, right? This was not a small number of people, husband and wife, each capping out at $2,300. This was, thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of people giving relatively smaller amounts of money. So to the extent that you see a lot of people giving those amounts of money, it's a pretty good way to keep score, right? If you put, you know, I don't actually give a lot of money to political campaigns, but when I plunk down my $100 or $200 or what have you, you know, that's somebody I really care about. And that's actually, I think, a good thing. But yeah, that's what we have to work with right now.
The maybe we could try to speculate on the reasons why some campaigns are struggling to raise money and some aren't. There are a limited number of people who have the ability to give money to anybody.
Right.
Perhaps those people have already made their decisions.
Well, I mean, traditionally, the Republicans have not had trouble raising money. And what you're seeing right now is the Democrats are raising significantly more. The Democratic field combined has raised significantly more than the Republican field combined. And I think, you know, what that reflects is not a lack of financial capacity on the part of Republican donors or potential Republican donors, but just a lack of enthusiasm for the candidates, for the party's prospects going forward in 2008. Whereas conversely, on the Democratic side, I think there's a strong feeling that 2008 promises to be a very good year for the Democrats. Hillary Clinton, to Democratic partisans, is an inspiring figure, a strong candidate, able to tap into her husband's fundraising network, and so brings all of those strengths to the table, and is she's drawing heavily there. And Barack Obama, just I think to a lot of people, they look not to inexperience, but they say, you know, here's a new face, compelling biography, just a captivating, magnetic personality, you know, and they get enthusiastic for that. So I think what you're seeing is enthusiasm on the Democratic side and something like despondency on the Republican side.
We're talking with Professor Joseph R. Reisert. He's a Harriet S. and George C. Wiswell, Jr. Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law and Chair of the Department of Government at Colby College. It's All Things Political. John Munson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. And we're going to take calls in just a moment. First, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we've got people who are already on the phone and waiting to talk about politics this hour, and I'll give the phone number one more time, and maybe we can get some more people to join us, because we do have an open phone line or two. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number anywhere you can hear the sound of this broadcast. If you're in Milwaukee, please call us at 414-227-2050 in Milwaukee. It's All Things Political. This morning, I'm John Munson, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up after 10 o'clock this morning, I'll be talking about the problem that a lot of college students have when they graduate, and I'm not talking about finding a job. I'm talking about paying off all that debt. If you have a college student who has just graduated or is about to graduate, you might want to grab them and get them in front of the radio at 10 o'clock this morning when we have a guest come in to explain how it's possible to get out of that debt. That is, get it paid off. I know I'll be paying attention. Of course, I'm going to be doing the program. This hour, it's All Things Political, and our guest is Joseph R. Reisert, a Harriet S. and George C. Wiswell, Jr. Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law and Chair of the Department of Government at Colby College. He's joining us by phone. And, Professor, how do you get all that on a business card?
Very small print.
I guess. We have full phone lines right now, so let's take some calls. I think we'll start with Matt in Lake Geneva. Matt, I believe you're next. We'll put you on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. You were just discussing the apparent malaise in the Republican presidential race. And I think you missed something. There's a candidate called Ron Paul that's raising quite a bit of enthusiasm in the Republican Party. He raised more money in the second quarter than John McCain did, but yet he seems to be invisible to the pundits and the people in the media. He won a straw poll of New Hampshire Taxpayer Alliance over this weekend. don't see that anywhere in the news unless I check the Ron Paul blogs. He came in second in a straw poll in Cobb County, Georgia, where Atlanta is this weekend. He came in second in the Utah straw poll about 2 weeks ago, Republican Party straw poll. Did very well in the big California Republican straw poll. He's raised all this money, and he's not even spending it because his supporters are so enthusiastic and so well-networked that they're not even using the money because the people are campaigning from a grassroots level for Ron Paul. And he's everywhere. I mean, the guy was not invited by some partisans to a Republican event in a forum in Iowa, and his supporters turned out en masse and dwarfed the number of people who had come for the candidate forum.
Who is Ron Paul? Tell us a little about him.
Well, Ron Paul's big calling card, right, is he's the strongest in opposition to the war. He wants to bring the troops home right off, and I think what you're seeing is that one position is what's drawing this energized support for him. And it's, you know, it's got to be really worrying to the mainstream, the media-anointed front-running candidates that an insurgent candidate with, you know, essentially experience in the House of Representatives, I believe, you know, is suddenly attracting this kind of energy, enthusiasm. I mean, in some ways, it looks like, you know, Howard Dean all over again, but on the Republican side this time. I mean, I suspect if any of the more prominent candidates, you know, were to move closer to an immediate withdrawal position, that the enthusiasm would then move to the other candidate. But yeah, I mean, it's a factor. It's an interesting development on the Republican side.
I think I wanted to get to this. The caller makes a good point in terms of all these straw polls, or at least that's a topic I wanted to raise. Given the way the primary system has shifted for this presidential election, do states like New Hampshire and Iowa really mean anything anymore?
Well, the truth is nobody really knows what the effect is going to be. I mean, it looks like we're essentially going to have a nationwide or virtually nationwide primary there early in February. And so one way of thinking is whoever manages to win one or two of these early rounds, New Hampshire, Iowa, South Carolina, then gets a lot of media attention, gets presented in the press as the likely winner, and so then, you know, cruises to victory in you know, the super-duper Tuesday or whatever we're calling it now. But the other theory could be, well, you know, New Hampshire, Iowa, especially those two, even South Carolina, not especially representative states. I don't see why, you know, a rational Californian voter or New York voter, what have you, shouldn't really care that much what a bunch of New Hampshire people decide. And so I'm not sure which it's going to be. I mean, I guess I kind of suspect that winning early still matters for the reason, you know, when you saw Senator Kerry do unexpectedly well against Howard Dean, that just took all the air out of the Dean campaign last time around. And so we might see something similar this time. I guess that's probably what will happen, but it's a new thing, and new things are unpredictable.
Let's take another call, and this time we'll go to Stephen in Madison. Stephen, good morning. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask the professor of constitutional law and governance, does he really believe that this entire kabuki dance, have another fake election, let the Diebold computers steal it if they need to, like, or let the Supreme Court order it one way or the other? And even, you know, the big money has to buy all the TV commercial time to pound into our brains. My question to the professor is, how close are we to a unitary executive dictatorship in this country? And also, does he believe that the body politic, that we are so deracinated, degraded, debased, deluded, that this dictatorship coming is, we can't resist it. We can't put in Ron Paul because we're not smart enough. And one more point, sir. Until we speak the truth about who put the demolitions in the towers, we won't get anywhere in this country. Could you comment on those 3 points?
Let's take them one at a time. The first one first. I'm trying to remember exactly what that was.
Is there any chance that someone can win who's substantially different from the president because money controls everything?
Okay.
I think that was the first point.
Yep, that was it.
And I think absolutely someone else is. I mean, you know, there's certainly no chance in the world that President Bush is going to attempt to stay in office past January of 2009, right? That's not going to happen. There's not 10 people in America who would support any sort of coup like that. So the winner of the next election is going to take office. The next election, right now, it looks very likely that a Democrat is going to win that election. You know, what we've seen is that election polling, you know, the opinion surveys that are done leading up to an election are pretty reliable indicators. They track pretty closely what the outcomes of the election are, and that suggests to me, at least, that the elections, for good or for bad, track, you know, the results track what the people want. Now, then the further question is, I suppose, are the people entirely manipulated by big media buys? And I guess I'm skeptical of that, and I'm skeptical of that for a couple of reasons. One is that, first of all, with the rise of the Internet, we're all now able, anybody who wants to at least, is able to get information from a whole variety of sources, far more different sources than, you know, 20, 30 years ago when the three major network news broadcasts were the dominant source. So we get this diversity of sources of information. You know, the new rise of social networking makes it easier for like-minded people to organize, to get together. Howard Dean could very easily have gotten the nomination, right? It wasn't that big a difference between him and Senator Kerry early on. That would have been something different. Senator Kerry, had he run a different campaign, might have been able to beat President Bush, right? A lot of people think.
Well, some people think he did anyway.
Well, you know, the difficulty with that argument, though, is the opinion surveys indicated he was going to lose, and he lost. Now, you know, one can re-argue the 2000 election, right, when Al Gore did win a popular majority, and the Florida election, as we all know, was thrown to the courts. The state courts went more or less in favor of Gore, and the Supreme Court of the United States ended the recount and decided in favor of President Bush. And, you know, I think there's probably very little new to be said about that, except that, you know, it's an unsatisfactory solution all the way around, except that I guess there had to be some resolution to that.
That's an interesting, and I don't want to spend too much time on the 2000 election because that's history, but I studied history in college, and so I guess I'd like to think I'm at least an armchair historian. I was listening to a program, and I'm just going to say it was on Wisconsin Public Radio just because I probably should, and it probably was where I heard it. But the analysis was that in 2000, while all the attention was being paid to Florida, West Virginia was really the state that killed Al Gore. It went heavily for George Bush, and that had to do with Gore's environmental stand against the coal industry.
Well, right. I mean, had Gore held West Virginia, which had been reliably Democratic until 2000, yeah, then the Florida thing wouldn't have mattered. And I think you're right. Coal had a very large role in turning West Virginia against Gore and toward Bush, certainly. But look, the larger point is, you know, do the election results correspond to what we have reason to believe the people actually are voting for? And so far, that's yes. Now, just as an aside, you know, I think the move to electronic voting is probably a terrible idea, and one of the reasons I don't like it is, you know, exactly this fear that computers can be tampered with much more easily than, you know, say, large numbers of paper ballots. But so far, at least, we don't have, you know, any real evidence that that's happened. We know the possibility is there with electronic voting, but I don't know. Baby boomers seem to be enchanted by computers, and they've been going all for it. So.
Well, this goes back to something, though, that you mentioned about the alternative sources of information that we have. A couple of things. One, yes, it is a lot easier to find like-minded individuals. Whatever your point of view is, somebody's probably got a website that supports it, whether it's a conspiracy theory about what really happened on 9/11, how voting machines are being tampered with, or whatever it is. There's somebody out there who's got a website or a blog, and you can go there and you can have your own opinions reinforced. It just seems, I guess I'll just take a little bit of a devil's advocate view. Doesn't what the Internet really accomplish is it allows us to filter out all the messages we don't want to hear and focus on only the things that make us feel better about what we believe.
Well, it absolutely allows that, right? I mean, there's no question that if you want only to encounter ideas, people you agree with, the Internet makes that a lot easier. And I guess, you know, the flip side of that, though, is that it also makes it possible for us, it maybe imposes on us the responsibility to, you know, look up online something we don't agree with. You know, you subscribe to The Nation, maybe you should look at the National Review online, right? You read the Weekly Standard, maybe you should read, you know, the American Prospect or something online. You know, the cost of acquiring information that you don't agree with has now gotten so low that, you know, I don't know, it seems to me a duty, really, to expose ourselves to things we don't agree with. But you're right, people who don't want to, and there's a strong human tendency to want to, you know, birds of a feather flock together is an old saying for a reason. The Internet does make that easier, but it also makes it easier to fight against it. So,
and then you have the whole Paris Hilton phenomenon, where her release from a jail sentence is the lead story and occupies a huge chunk of the nightly news the day that it happens, and it's all over all the tabloids, and not just the tabloids, where that kind of thing used to be, that was where it was restricted to. But it's all over the mainstream media, and it's like, you know, who cares? There was a website formed called GoAwayParis.com, and I was very amused to see how somebody was merchandising the anti-Paris feeling. They've got T-shirts and all sorts of other stuff they're selling. You know, that's I guess that's the beauty of capitalism. There's always a way to exploit any situation for profit. Let's go back to the phones. And before I do that, I just want to mention the phone numbers again, because we do have a couple of open lines for you if you'd like to join us on All Things Political for this Monday. It's 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number to call. That's good anywhere you can hear this broadcast, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, use our local number, 414-227-2050, 227-2050. My guest this hour, who's helping with the analysis, is Joseph R. Reissert, Harriet S. and George C. Wiswell, Jr., Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law and Chair of the Department of Government at Colby College. And we're talking about all things political. Well, we've got some people who've been on hold for a little while. Let's talk to Robert in Madison. Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
All right. Thank you. Clearly, the biggest political problem that this country faces and both party faces is the Iraq situation. Secondly, it seems to me that at this particular point in time, the only alternative is indeed to leave Iraq. Other than the fact that this will be an embarrassment for this current administration of the most politically naive foreign policy ever conducted by the United States government, that would be one problem. That would be an embarrassment. And other than the fact that it would be a financial embarrassment of major proportions approaching $1 trillion, which is a second embarrassment. The third thing, the alternative, indeed, would result, in my opinion, and this is where I want someone else's opinion, in the following certainties. The certainties being, one, that Syria, Saudi Arabia, will checkmate any attempt by Iran to take over Iraq. Okay? Number two, that prior to us leaving Iraq, we would inform Syria, Jordan, and Egypt, and Saudi Arabia that we are indeed leaving, and that if they want Iran to take over Iraq, then, you know, that'll be their decision. Number two, that us leaving will lead to some form of additional fighting and additional civil war, but like these countries have always had in the past, they will reach a state of equilibrium. And indeed, we'll come to a solution where they're tired of killing each other's mothers and sons. And number three, I forgot my point number three, but that we would reach equilibrium. And number three, yes, the number three point is that the one group in that area of the world will become persona non grata will be Al Qaeda. Because those governments are not interested in the mission and statements of Al-Qaeda. They are interested in their own destiny and preservation of their own destiny. So Al-Qaeda will be the first group that will be kicked out by all four or five of those countries.
Okay, let's try and deal with these things piecemeal.
I mean, I clearly, you know, agree that the policy has been disastrous. I think everyone agrees with that. Disastrous, embarrassing, naive, you know, is it quite as bad as getting us into the War of 1812? You know, maybe. You know, at least the White House hasn't been burned yet. But, you know, clearly it's been a disastrous, failed policy. What are the consequences of our leaving? You know, the account the caller gives is about as optimistic an account, I think, as there is. And, you know, if the caller's account is correct, then I think, you know, we'll be doing pretty well, right? That the major Sunni powers managed to get their act together sufficiently to form an alliance to check the rising power of Iran. There is relatively quickly achieved a certain kind of more or less peaceful equilibrium, and everyone recognizes a common interest in getting rid of Al-Qaeda. That would be great. You know, there are reasons to worry that that's not going to happen. You know, one is it's not entirely clear that Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria can work together effectively. I mean, Syria up to now has been actually, though predominantly Sunni in its rulers, allied with Shiite theocratic Iran. But assuming, you know, you could get a configuration of Sunni powers to stand up to defend the interests of the Sunni minority in Iraq, to serve as some kind of bulwark against rising Iranian power there. You know, maybe. You know, so far they haven't demonstrated a lot of military or political capacity. You know, it does seem much more likely that Iran is the big winner. And, you know, it may be that there's no investment we can make, there's no policy decision we can take right now that's going to prevent that. So I wouldn't be as certain that there will be a sort of even stalemate in Iraq. The second is the search to achieve a kind of equilibrium. I mean, when it's put that way, it sounds very, you know, pleasant and all, but the likely way in which this equilibrium is going to be achieved will be basically by war, right? Much more open, much more bloody conflict between Sunni, between Shia, among the Shia, probably among the Sunni. And, you know, we don't like sitting by and watching civilians getting murdered on the television, right? We're horrified by what's going on in Darfur, or go back a ways to what happened during the wars in Yugoslavia. And there's sort of every reason to think that when we leave, Iraq becomes Yugoslavia writ large, with maybe Saudi Arabia and Iran having a kind of proxy war in the middle. I mean, that's not a pleasant prospect. The advantage is we can get out of it, at least in the short run. But, gosh, I wish we knew some way of bringing peace and stability there. Our military presence, such as it is, doesn't seem to be doing that, though. So,
Well, there doesn't seem to be any fairy dust to sprinkle on this. I mean, it's a mess. No matter whose perspective you look at it from, I think that's one thing everybody agrees on. What they might not agree on is what we do next. And I think, you know, some people don't necessarily think these things through. It becomes we're so used to the kind of bumper sticker or sloganeering politics of the, say, the last couple of decades that we started to believe that we can solve problems simply by giving them a cool name. I don't know. It's a difficult problem. Let's take another call, and then we'll take a break. Eldon in Duluth, Minnesota, has been holding for quite a while. Eldon, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for holding.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering. I remember seeing a poll, I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I can't remember who did it, that the majority of Americans were interested in a Democratic president. But when the same poll actually broke down like head-to-head matchups among a lot of the Republican and Democratic frontrunners, some of the more minor ones too, but most of the frontrunners, that the Republican candidates were still ahead in the polls and winning. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on that, that there seems to be kind of a general Democratic feeling, but when the candidates are actually broken down head-to-head, that the Republicans were still ahead.
Right. We've seen this a lot, and I think it's often been Rudy Giuliani that benefits in these polls. I mean, some of them are now showing what the caller is saying is that if you ask people sort of generically, do you want a Democrat or a Republican, the Democrats have done very well. If you ask, suppose the election were held today and it was Hillary Clinton versus, say, Rudy Giuliani, who would you vote for? When these sort of head-to-head, you know, name against name matchups are polled, suddenly these Republican frontrunners do pretty well in these polls. And so the question is, what does that mean? Partly at this stage, relatively little. With the Hillary Clinton numbers, it may just reflect her very high negatives, right, among a decent swath of the population, whereas somebody like Giuliani, what little is known about him, you know, in the wider country is, oh, yeah, he was this, stand-up guy, hero of 9/11. As more is known about him, you know, those numbers will become more meaningful. Again, you'd probably have to go through each pairing because the results we're getting now really are, going to be a function of how much and what people know about the various candidates. And I think that, so I think we can still take them with something of a grain of salt.
I'm trying to remember the last time a New York Republican was nominated by his party for president. Was it Thomas Dewey? I'm not sure. Well, we'll think about it and take a break, and then we'll come back and we'll take some more phone calls. 800-486-8655 or 227-2050 are the numbers to use. John Munson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 947, you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson sitting in for Kathleen Dunn this morning. And this hour, we're doing all things political, and we have some open phone lines if you'd like to join us in the last 13 minutes of the show. 800-486-8655. It's toll-free anywhere you can hear this broadcast. In Milwaukee, please call us at 227-2050, 227-2050. My guest is Joseph R. Reisert, Harriet S. and George C. Wiswell, Jr., Associate Professor of American Constitutional Law and Chair of the Department of Government at Colby College. Colby College is in Maine, I believe, isn't it?
It is in Maine. Waterville, Maine.
Okay, and you have a Division III hockey team.
We do. We're Division III across the board.
Division III hockey happens to be a passion of mine, and I'm in a definite minority there. At any rate, we're not supposed to be talking about hockey this hour. It's politics. And one of the things that came up last week, there's two more things I want to be sure that we get to before the end of the hour. And one in particular, because you're holding this constitutional law chair, I wanted to talk to you about the looming constitutional crisis between the Senate, particularly Senator Leahy, and the executive branch over what documents can be withheld and what can't. And specifically, the question that I have is, does the administration really want a constitutional confrontation in the Supreme Court because they figure they'll win there? And that's why they're not cooperating, because they don't think they have to?
Well, I think they want the confrontation because certainly the vice president believes in a wider scope for executive power and executive privilege than has been recognized up to now. I mean, the vice president's sort of whole perspective seems to be that, you know, all of the developments since Watergate to limit the executive branch have been a mistake. And so, you know, I think from their point of view, they're trying to make a principled stand, right? The executive needs to have these wide-ranging discretionary authorities in order to meet national emergencies. And, you know, they believe that the Constitution confers these privileges on the executive branch, and so they want to defend them. And I think, sure, the fact that you now have a more conservative Supreme Court with a new Chief Justice, a new Justice Alito on the court, I think they think, you know, they may have a fair shot at winning. I doubt they're correct in that assessment, but I think, you know,
why do you say that?
Well, the courts, I mean, you go back to some of the Clinton era privilege cases, you know, the Clinton versus Jones case. I mean, the court there, oh gosh, what is it? I haven't taught this case in a while, but it's about 8-1. You know, to require Clinton to go forward with testifying in this civil suit. And the courts, and I think this is, you know, this is what courts do. Courts want the rule of law. They want everybody to be subjected to rules. They don't like exceptions. They don't like just sort of saying, oh, well, you know, the president can do whatever he wants. The courts, even in the Nixon case, from Watergate, said, well, there is an executive privilege, only, you know, it's really small and it doesn't cover these tapes. And this sphere of privilege has been gradually diminishing. Now, it's true that Alito and Roberts are more conservative. They're more prosecutor-friendly. They're more government-friendly. But I think that doesn't necessarily translate into being more sympathetic to claims of executive privilege, where, you know, in effect, the administration is claiming, well, we have the right to just ignore a subpoena. I think the original design of our Constitution, you know, if you were to go all the way back, you know, is really to leave a lot of these fights to the sphere of politics. In other words, you know, Congress is going to make it. Push for documents, the president is going to push back. Sooner or later, there will be another election. The result of the election will sort of just show us, you know, where the balance of power lies, and somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. The whole modern trend has been to take things out of political fighting, right, and to move them into the courts. I mean, go back to Bush against Gore, right? The Constitution has a mechanism for sorting out controverted electoral college votes. We could have thrown the election to the House of Representatives in January. But nobody wants to do that. We want to have the rule of law. We want courts to make decisions. And I think, you know, at the end of the day, the courts are going to, you know, if there is no compromise on this, the courts are going to decide, and my bet is they would decide against a claim of privilege here.
The other issue that I wanted to touch on this morning, and I haven't seen anyone call in about this yet, and we will get to phone calls in just a moment. The popularity of Congress is plummeting, and it's they're right down there with used car salespeople right now. The Democrats came in on a wave of support. They had an agenda. They had a bunch of stuff they were going to do in the first 100 hours. They really only got one of those things turned into law, and I don't even remember what that one was. And yet, I mean, they're talking the talk, and they're trying to pass legislation. But they're really struggling. And if you believe public opinion polls, the public isn't happy with the way Congress has comported itself.
Well, I think that's completely right. Although, you know, when we look back at the 06 election, you know, the question really has to be how much of that election is a vote for a Democratic Party and a Democratic agenda, and how much of that is a vote against, you know, by proxy, against President Bush, against his policy in Iraq, and so forth. And, you know, to the extent that the 06 vote is really a vote against President Bush, it's maybe not that surprising that, you know, very little positive has yet come. I think it's the minimum wage is the only thing we saw.
Yes, that was it. Right.
We saw action on, and the minimum wage, you know, was sweetened with a number of tax breaks for small business to get, you know, enough Republicans so the thing would go through. Congress is looking bad because there are major issues out there, and Congress isn't coming through with major solutions. In part, that's, you know, it's the Democrats control both houses, but by narrow slivers, and there's not an ideological majority, you know, for the what you would think of as the core Democratic agenda. So the Democrats' challenge is going to be to have a presidential candidate and to have elections in the Congress where they can present, you know, an affirmative positive agenda and give people reason to believe that with a new occupant in the White House, they can get that agenda through. Right? Conversely, the Republicans, I think, need to, I mean, the Republicans' great problem at the moment is that what we really have yet to see is what their new agenda is. Right? The Republicans are still saying, well, the Democrats will allow the Bush tax cuts to expire, and that's in effect a tax increase, and we're against tax increases. And the Republicans are saying, well, you know, the Democrats are weak on terrorism, and we're strong on terrorism, so vote for us. But the Republicans, right, they're all still trying to be Ronald Reagan. They don't know yet what they want to be positively. So that, you know, it's hard to see how that helps Republicans trying to unseat Democrats, even though the Congress as a whole is unpopular. So I realize that the Congress as a whole is unpopular. It ought to be an anti-incumbent thing, but I don't think that the Republicans are yet well positioned to take advantage from what could turn into an anti-incumbent mood.
Let's get a caller in here because we're running short of time. Sue in Door County, you're next. Good morning, Sue. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I just have a question about Scooter Libby and Cheney. Excuse me, and I'd like to your comments on the secret administration of Dick Cheney and the pardon of Scooter Libby.
Well, Scooter Libby wasn't pardoned. He had his sentence commuted. The guilty verdict is still in place, and the fines and probation that were part of the sentence are still in place. So that's he wasn't pardoned. His sentence was commuted. That's a different thing. But what about the Cheney administration? What Doonesbury calls the black division of government, or I don't know, the black branch of government. It's a new fourth branch of government, and you know, that's kind of funny. But some of this stuff is pretty serious.
Well, you know, it's clear that Vice President Cheney is as influential, probably the most influential vice president we've ever had. And that influence, you know, because he's more ideologically, what's the word I'm looking for? Ideologically pure, ideologically committed, ideologically extreme, maybe, than we suspect President Bush to be, you know, it attracts a lot of attention and criticism. But we all need to bear in mind that if President Bush were unpersuaded by the arguments made by the vice president and by his staff, then, you know, it would be a trivial matter for the president to sideline him. So the fact is, the vice president has all of this influence because ultimately they're persuading, he is and his staff are persuading the president. And, you know, the argument, I think that the aspect of it that people find most troubling is the very strong conception of executive authority that the vice president holds. And, you know, it's true. They're trying to, well, as they would put it, roll back the clock to before Watergate, which even in that formulation, a lot of people would find troubling.
Well, that's a good place for us to leave this discussion. I really appreciate your time this morning, Professor Reiser. Thanks for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
This program was produced by Rhonda Fanning with on-air production by Mimi Notstein and Bill Estes. It's program number 79D. If you'd like a copy, call the radio store. It's 747. It's 800-747-7444. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network.